here we find ourselves looking at this point for an exit. But we want an exit that at least leaves some semblance of order.
Peace remains elusive in Afghanistan. It's Monday, February 11th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, preparations continue for Trump-Kim summit. Suicides high among Australia's indigenous residents. Shanghai tunnels hide historic drug trade. A new measles outbreak and green roofs. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hopes for a peace plan in Afghanistan have been waning in recent weeks after top U.S. officials walked back reports the outlines for an agreement were in place. Still, U.S. officials and the Taliban continue to meet, with both at least paying lip service to the idea that all is not lost. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports the top American negotiator believes there's a chance something can get done before Afghanistan's next election, which is just 5 months away.
After decades of war, 17 involving U.S. forces, hopes that the hour of peace with the Taliban in Afghanistan is almost at hand.
They say they want legitimacy. They have learned from their mistakes of the past, that they want to be not isolated, be a pariah state.
U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, on Friday called such words encouraging. And he said there's even a chance for a final peace deal before Afghans next go to the polls.
Between now and July, there is sufficient time, I believe, where we could reach an agreement. But at least if we have significant progress, that will have a good impact.
But for that to happen, negotiators will need to answer critical questions, like, when will U.S. forces finally be gone? For the Taliban, it can't happen soon enough.
We are in negotiation with the American side, and we are trying that the American forces should go out as soon as it is possible.
In return, the U.S. wants assurances the Taliban will not let terror groups like Al-Qaeda or Islamic State use Afghanistan as a base. While the Taliban have offered such guarantees, Pentagon officials doubt they can deliver.
A significant or sudden drawdown of our counter-terror ability or footprint would be a risk.
Complicating matters, U.S. President Donald Trump has made it clear he wants U.S. troops to come home sooner rather than later.
So here we find ourselves looking at this point for an exit. But we want an exit that at least leaves some semblance of order rather than an invitation to chaos.
That fear of chaos weighs heavily on the mind of many Afghans, wary of both the U.S. and the Taliban.
If the Taliban choose a better and soft policy for youth, we will be happy. But if it is a repeat of the 2001 era, then we are not happy with it.
Khalilzad says in the end, negotiations may come down to whether the Taliban can appreciate that the country they once ruled has changed.
The message that they have given me is that they understand that they cannot go back.
Many Afghans are hoping, one way or another, promises of peace will finally be realized. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. South Korea and United States reach payment deal on U.S. troops. People flee escalating violence in Myanmar's Rakhine southern Chin states. U.S. and China face off over legacy in Cambodia. Ex-Malaysia Prime Minister on charm offensive before graft trial. Thai King dashes sister's political dreams. Expanded coverage of all these stories and a whole lot more, pictures and video too, are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also visit our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Stephen Bagan said talks with North Korea that wrapped up Friday in Pyongyang for the preparation of the second summit with North Korea February 27th and 28th were productive. Bagan met South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Hwang-hwai Saturday in Seoul.
We don't know where it's going to go, but we are in the midst of a conversation with the North, and our discussions were productive.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced via Twitter earlier that his meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would take place in Vietnam's capital, Hanoi, and Bagan was hopeful for a meaningful meeting.
The president is very much looking forward to taking the next steps. We have some hard work to do with the DPRK between now and then, and I'm confident that if both sides stay committed, we can make real progress.
In his tweet, the president added he looks forward to seeing Chairman Kim and advancing the cause of peace. Trump also tweeted, North Korea under the leadership of Kim Jong-un will become a great economic powerhouse. South Korea's Kang was upbeat about Bagan's news from Pyongyang.
You have our fullest support as you move forward in preparation for the summit and beyond.
Speaking last week at Stanford University, Bagan outlined the administration's goals for the upcoming talks with Kim Jong-un.
Before the process of denuclearization can be final, we must also have a complete understanding of the full extent of the North Korean weapons of mass destruction and missile programs. We will get that at some point through a comprehensive declaration. We must reach agreement on expert access and monitoring mechanisms of key sites international standards. And ultimately, we need to ensure the removal and destruction of stockpiles of fissile material, weapons, missiles, launchers, and other weapons of mass destruction. President Trump has made clear, both to North Korea as well as to our team, that he expects significant and verifiable progress on denuclearization, actions that are bold and real to emerge from that next summit.
The U.S. State Department said Bagan has agreed to meet his North Korean counterpart, Kim Hyuk-chol, at least once more prior to the summit taking place. The State Department also says that during the 3 days of talks in Pyongyang, Bagan and Kim discussed advancing President Trump and Chairman Kim's Singapore summit commitments of complete denuclearization, transforming U.S. DPRK relations, and building a lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. Happening now in Asia, Turkey has condemned China's treatment of its Muslim ethnic Uyghur people as a great embarrassment for humanity, adding to rights groups' recent criticism of mass detentions of the Turkic-speaking minority. The northwest Xinjiang region of China, where most Uyghurs live, has been under heavy police surveillance. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We start out yet another week here on VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us. Intergenerational trauma and poverty are being blamed for a series of suicides by young Aboriginal people in Western Australia. The Kimberley region has been one of the highest suicide rates in the world, and a coroner has published her report into more than a dozen deaths, including that of a 10-year-old girl who took her own life in 2016. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The coroner blamed a cluster of suicides in the Kimberley region of Western Australia on the crushing effects of intergenerational trauma. It's the catastrophic and lasting impact of European colonisation, as well as the loss of tribal land and culture. Five of the victims investigated by the inquest were Indigenous children aged between 10 and 13. They often lived in dysfunctional homes and were exposed to alcohol abuse and violence. Western Australian Police Sergeant Neville Rip hopes the coroner's report will help authorities recognise the danger signs.
It's a wake-up call for everyone to protect your children, for us as police officers to pick up on these warning signs.
The coroner has made 42 recommendations, including restrictions on alcohol sales and screening babies for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Drinking during pregnancy can cause lifelong mental and physical problems and is thought to have been a factor in the Kimberley suicides. There have been several official reports into Indigenous self-harm in Western Australia in the past two decades, but little has changed. Rob McPhee from the Kimberley Aboriginal Medical Service hopes that communities will have a greater say in how these tragedies can be prevented.
I think the coroner this time has taken a much broader approach in terms of looking at things like self-determination and empowerment. They're things that are hard to do, and they're things that governments struggle with because it's about shifting control and power back to community, and governments really have a lot of trouble doing that.
Community leaders, however, doubt that this new report will save lives. Benedicta Pindon is an elder in the township of Luma, where a 10-year-old girl took her own life.
It was just someone coming out to tick the boxes to say, I've been to Luma to speak to them about suicide, mental issues. I'm telling you, that's what we call them, tick the box people.
The Western Australian government said these are complex issues that won't be solved overnight. It insists alcohol is devastating Aboriginal communities and that tougher regulations are urgently needed. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of the population. They suffer high rates of poverty, ill health, and imprisonment.
Phil Mercer is also following the 10th anniversary of Australia's worst ever bushfire disaster, when 173 people died in the state of Victoria. Thousands of homes were destroyed as dozens of fires tore through the southern state. The tragedy led to a revamp of emergency warning systems.
Black Saturday is how Australians refer to a February 2009 bushfire disaster that killed 173 people and left hundreds more injured. The blaze left more than 2,000 homes in ruins and thousands of people displaced. Authorities estimate that up to 1 million animals died. There weren't just a handful of fires, but hundreds. About 400 blazes burned across Victoria State. Most were sparked by lightning and faulty power lines, but others had been set deliberately by arsonists. Carol Matthews' son Sam was killed when the family home burnt down. She recalls the last time she spoke with him on the phone as the flames moved closer.
We only had a 30-second conversation. And when he started, he was anxious but not panicked. A tree blew up and then there was fire all around him. And then I heard this pop, 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 and I said, what's that? And he said, all the windows have blown in. In my heart, as soon as the windows had blown in, I knew that there wasn't much hope for him. And although I tried about 15 to 20 times to ring him back, we never heard from him again.
The disaster was caused by a deadly cocktail of record temperatures, unusually strong winds, and a long-running drought, conditions that are affecting Australia today. Earlier this month, the Australian Bureau of Meteorology reported that January was the hottest month ever recorded in the country, with a mean temperature that exceeded 30 degrees Celsius. An official inquiry into the 2009 tragedy resulted in sweeping changes to the way Australia prepares for and fights bushfires, including better early warning systems for residents. New homes in vulnerable areas are also subject to stricter building regulations. Southeastern Australia is one of the world's most fire-prone regions. Between 1967 and 2013, major bushfires in Australia have caused about 8,000 injuries and more than 430 deaths. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, concerns about drugs from China date back a century ago under the streets of Portland, Oregon. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This News from VOA Asia. South Korea and the United States have signed a new preliminary agreement increasing the amount Seoul will pay for having U.S. troops in South Korea. South Korea will pay about $890 million, about $60 million more than last year. Previous agreements lasted for 5 years. Sundays is only set for one. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Portland, Oregon is considered one of the friendliest and most laid-back cities in the United States. But it hasn't always been this way. About 100 years ago, Portland was home to a number of criminal gangs that used a sprawling network of underground tunnels and secret passages to kidnap locals and trade in opium. Masha Morton has the story.
Imagine coming to one of Portland's many restaurants, Hobos, for example. You're having a good time listening to live music and having a drink. And then suddenly,
bartender would press a buzzer. Two people would be down here maybe playing checkers or cards. They'd jump up and get ready. And then the bartender would pull the lever. Down they would come.
Michael Jones is a historian whose main passion is Portland's criminal past, one that has remained invisible to most. Originally, he says, the city's complex network of underground tunnels was built to move goods from the ships docked on the Willamette River to basement storage area. But there is documentation that many of these passages were constructed by local gangs for their shady business. One crime ring called Shanghaiers specialized in kidnapping. According to Jones, they also operated in these tunnels.
Shanghaiers were men to provide labor for the ships for nothing. Now that's putting it very politely. That's just what it means. They would kidnap men in any way, shape, or form and sell them for $50 a head.
The many ships that docked in Portland needed manpower. The kidnapped men filled that niche. If they tried to escape, they were quickly caught, and their captors took away their shoes to keep them from trying again. Jones says historians know the tunnels were used as opium dens and by those who fancied a drink during Prohibition. They also served as a venue for illegal fight clubs and underground brothels. Women who were forced to work there were kidnapped too.
They'd grab them from dances, restaurants right off the street, would bring them to the underground, lock them up in holding cells. These were like double-walled closets. They were called white slaver cells. And that's where they're supposed to break them, meaning make them believe they can never go back home again.
The illicit activities ceased in the 1940s as police raids became more frequent and their consequences much more severe. Today it's hard to believe that liberal Portland has such a dark past. But to Jones, it's yet another reason to never forget what happened in the dark underground tunnels and to never repeat the horrible mistakes of the past. Masha Morton, Mike Maisoradze for VOA News, Portland, Oregon.
This news from VOA Asia. Thailand's king has crushed the plans of his older sister to become a candidate for the country's prime minister. The political hopes of the princess evaporated when her younger brother, the king, issued a terse statement saying his sister's candidacy was highly inappropriate and went against tradition and national culture. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, health officials in the United States are urging parents to get their children vaccinated for measles after a spike in the number of cases. On February 5th, there were 50 cases reported in the state of Washington and another 5 cases in Houston, Texas. VOA's Carol Pearson reports most of the cases are in unvaccinated children.
Measles was eliminated in the U.S. 19 years ago. The only cases now are those that are imported from other countries. That's happening in the U.S. with greater frequency.
Measles is incredibly contagious. Once it gets around the community, it's very difficult because it's airborne.
18 states allow parents not to vaccinate their children if they have moral, personal, or philosophical objections to it. A measles outbreak in Washington state has health officials scrambling to contain it.
I hope I'm wrong, but I think the cases are going to get more frequent and spread throughout the country from this epicenter.
Rural areas in the U.S. tend to have higher numbers of unvaccinated children, but there are significant numbers in cities such as Houston, Austin, and Seattle, where immunization rates are low. Houston just reported two cases of measles in children under the age of two. Doctors, including the U.S. Surgeon General, are urging parents to get their children vaccinated.
As the United States Surgeon General, I want everyone to know that the best protection against measles is getting vaccinated.
The vaccine is almost 100% effective. Doctors recommend that children get two doses of the vaccine.
One dose of vaccine, about 95% of children will become protected against measles. The reason that we give a second dose is because about 5% of children do not respond to the first dose. So with two doses, over 99% of children are protected against measles.
Measles makes people very sick. It's especially dangerous for children.
One-third of those cases will end up hospitalized, and that may be due to a variety of complications.
Complications such as pneumonia or encephalitis, a swelling of the brain, can be deadly or lead to permanent disability. That's why doctors urge parents to get their children vaccinated. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Excess rainwater flowing into streams and waterways carrying pollutants and contaminants is a problem for urban areas across the country. To combat it, an increasing number of cities across the United States are initiating programs like rooftop gardens to help absorb the rain and, in some cases, also grow food. VOA's Julie Tabo takes us to a rooftop garden in Washington, D.C. It's a city with one of the greatest numbers of green roofs.
Rain is essential for life, but too much of it can lead to flooding, causing sewers to overflow and carry contaminants to nearby river systems. The city of Washington, D.C. has an innovative way to deal with that. This rooftop garden on the campus of the University of the District of Columbia includes a variety of vegetation to help absorb excess rainwater and grow food at the same time. Architect David Bell designed five green roofs on the campus.
And we were really excited about this project because it started to do something more than just dealing with stormwater management. It took advantage of a resource above the city that you see all over, where you have these flat roofs that aren't doing anything, and really made it something that was about urban agriculture.
Graduate student Caitlin Arlotta says the project is part of a research initiative to see what plants are best suited for rooftop environments, both for food as well as pollination.
These are the tomatoes that we're growing. We have the same experiment running with tomatoes as we do with strawberries, so we're doing variety trials and we're trying just to see which variety grows the best in a green roof setting. In an urban environment, you don't have maybe all that many spaces to choose from, and so rooftops are just unutilized space. So it's a really good way to not have to restructure your city necessarily and be able to incorporate green roofs.
Arlotta says the main goal of the program is to have food justice.
So bringing fresh food into cities where you wouldn't necessarily have that access.
That includes produce for immigrant members of the community as well.
In the U.S., it may not seem very common to use hibiscus leaves and sweet potato leaves as food, but in many places around the world, it is.
My biggest surprise was that we produced 4,250 pounds of produce the first year and was able to disseminate that to people in need.
Sandy Farber-Bandier is coordinator of the school's Master Gardener program.
This is the future for food. What we have established here at this college is food hub concept of you grow it here, you prepare it in a commercial kitchen, you distribute it through farmers markets, food trucks, and then you recycle.
While D.C. is home to one of the largest numbers of green roofs in the country, not all of them are designed to grow food. David Bell hopes that over time that will change, providing a better connection to nature and better fresh food for the city. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. One of the fun ways to hear our program is on the radio. Many great radio stations across Asia carry our program, like DZUP, 1602 AM radio, at the University of the Philippines, Diliman, in Quezon City. We're very glad everyone there has tuned into our program today. Thanks for listening. You can also find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, of course, VOA Asia Facebook, and our website, voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Aydin Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team is Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day.